Now this week we're to consider the testimony of the spade, or if you like, archaeology, digging up the past. The archaeologist digging in places where the history of the Bible is said to have taken place confirms again and again the truth of the Bible narrative. Up until about the middle of the last century, the 1800s, there was very little going beyond about 500 years before Christ. There was the Bible, and there was the Old Testament. But the Old Testament spoke of cities which had long since disappeared and no trace of them could be found. The Old Testament spoke about conquerors whose names had long since disappeared from all records. The Old Testament spoke about nations which were largely forgotten. And so, of course, a great doubt was often cast upon the historical value of the Old Testament, of the Bible. Some people cast doubt upon the historical value of the New Testament as well. Well, now all that has changed in the last 100 and or so years. There has been an ever-growing wealth of material which has come to light through the work of archaeologists digging in Palestine, of course, and also in Egypt, in Mesopotamia, and other places relating to the Bible. Biblical archaeology, and it's a fascinating subject. Now, I want to say, as part of this introduction, our faith does not rest upon this testimony. We don't believe the Bible because the archaeologist says it's true or confirms its history. That would be much too shaky a foundation. We should be terrified every time he unearthed something which seemed to cast doubt upon something in the Bible. Our faith rests upon other grounds than the testimony of the spade. Nevertheless, like the testimony of reason and the testimony of the Bible itself, it is a testimony which must be considered. And it is of great value. Its primary value, I would suggest, is to give us an insight into the background of the Bible and to an understanding of the Bible, rather than to bolster up somebody's shaky faith in the Bible. But nevertheless, it has value, and that's why we're considering it in this list of seven. Of course, the moment we begin the Old Testament, we are in the realm of biblical archaeology almost. Not at the very beginning. There was nobody there, and there was nobody writing when man was created. But take the flood, for example, that occupies Genesis chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9, the story of the great deluge. Archaeologists have found accounts of a great flood, a tremendous deluge, not only in other places in the Near East, but also on the continent of America, and Australia, and India, and even Tibet. In fact, right across the world, there are accounts that have come to light of an ancient flood. I'll take the story of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. Babylon, ancient Babylon, Babel, Babylon, has been excavated, and there are those who would claim to have found the ruins of the Tower of Babel, some 300 feet high. Whether it is the ruins of the biblical one or not is open to question, but there have been these things found. Or then take the city of Ur in Chaldea. All that was known about it at one time was that Abraham once lived there. Now, with the excavations of Sir Leonard Woolley in the 1920s and many others, there has come to light a tremendous amount of material describing this great Chaldean city of Ur, which Abraham left. But I want to concentrate your attention tonight on this, just this one short talk consideration upon some very interesting pieces of confirmation, in some cases of things that were disputed at one time from the Bible. Let's take first of all Genesis chapter 12 and verse 16. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 16. I have put some headings and references on the blackboard. If you can't see them, you can get them afterwards, of course, as usual. But this we might entitle Abraham's Wealth. Abraham had gone down into Egypt because of a famine in Canaan. Now, we won't get into the question of whether he should have done that or not. All we're concerned about is verse 16. And it says there, the second sentence, and he had sheep and oxen, and he asses, and men servants, and maid servants, and she asses, and camels. Now, there were those who said he can't possibly have had camels because there were no camels in Egypt until about the 4th century BC. And Abraham lived more than 1,000 years before that. And in fact, in the 1930 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, this was categorically stated that there were no camels in Egypt until the 4th century before Christ. So therefore this was wrong. However, more recently they have found a rope of camel's hair in Egypt dated about 1500 BC. 1,000 years before it was said there had never been any camels in Egypt. And since then further pieces of pottery and plaques have come to light with pictures of camels upon them, and it's now known there were most certainly camels in Egypt in Abraham's time. But they, for some reason or other, that scholars, as far as I know, haven't yet come up with the answer to this, for some reason or other, the Egyptians didn't seem to like drawing camels or putting camels too often on their bas-reliefs and illustrations. And that's why, for a long time, scholars were saying there weren't any camels. But there were, and the Bible said so. On the other hand, you'll notice it does not say that Abraham had any horses. He was rich, he had sheep, oxen, asses, men servants, maid servants, she asses and camels. But he didn't have any horses, which is a rather surprising omission for a land that became famous for its horses. Egyptian horses was one of the biggest exports. They exported as many horses as Iceland does fish from Egypt. It was famous for its horses, Arab stallions, Egyptian horses, and yet he didn't have any horses. Now it's very interesting. Archaeologists have now confirmed that the horse did not come to Egypt until the time of a particular invasion of some shepherd kings and peoples called the Hyksos, which was a time after Abraham's time. So there were no horses in his time. The Bible is true. The history, even little details like that. Well, let's take the question of writing in the second place. In Exodus 17 and verse 4. Exodus 17 and verse 4. 14, sorry. Exodus 17, 14, is it? Does it refer to writing? Yes, 14, I beg your pardon. Not 4, 14. Exodus chapter 17, verse 14. And the Lord said unto Moses, now this is the bit, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. Well, now there were some people who said for many, many years, well, that was false because writing hadn't been invented in the time of Moses. Moses lived about 1300 years before Christ, 1300 BC. And they said writing had not been invented, so therefore Moses couldn't possibly have written anything in a book. Moses didn't write the first five books of the Bible, and all the other references, and there are a lot of them, to Moses and those other patriarchs' writing are quite false. But in 1887, you see, as recently as that, 1887, a peasant woman in Egypt came to a mound which became known as Tel El Amarna, and she was hunting around for anything that she might be able to find to sell, just like people might go beach combing early in the morning on Bournemouth Beach, especially in the summer. She was just seeing if she could find anything that had left behind that she could sell to a museum or something like that. And she found some flat dried clay tablets. She took them along to a dealer and he bought them for about 20p, or the equivalent of about 20p. Today you couldn't buy those tablets for £2 million. They turned out to be letters from Amenhotep IV, or King Akhenaten, from him and to him. It was his correspondence file, actually, which his secretary had filed away in the Tel El Amarna mound, and that this lady had unearthed. And he lived 1400 BC. So he lived before the time of Moses, and he'd written an awful lot of letters. And so there was writing at the time of Moses. Of course, once that started and these 377 letters were found, well, more of them, so those 377 came from Palestine, there were many others, people began to find writing going back earlier still. In 1901, a French archaeologist called Morgan, Monsieur Morgan, he was at Susa in the Persian Gulf, and he unearthed a large black stone 8 feet high and 20 feet wide with this same cuneiform writing on it. It's called the Diorite Stone. It contains some laws of a king, King Hammurabi. Very close writing of these laws. And Hammurabi was a king in 1750 BC, which was about the same time as Abraham. So writing was invented not only by the time of Moses, but 400 years before. Now we know that we have writing going back to about 3,000 years before Christ. So, when God told Moses to write certain things in a book, writing had been invented and been used for at least 2,000 years. So much for those who said Moses couldn't have written the Pentateuch. And then there's the interesting story of how David took Jerusalem. The second book of Samuel, chapter 5. Now, Jerusalem was an ancient city, and it was thought to be unconquerable. The only way to take this Jebusite fortress city of Jerusalem, with its very high walls, its amazing position on a hilltop, its very thick ramparts, was to besiege it. And to hope to starve them out. And yet David the king somehow overcame it. And there is very little told us in the Bible. 2 Samuel 5 verse 6 and following. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spake unto David, saying, Except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither. Thinking David cannot come in hither. You see, they boasted. They shouted down from the ramparts, we put all our unemployed and disabled on defending this town. The blind and the lame, they're the people who defend this town. They were sort of being very cocky, weren't they? We don't need professional soldiers because, well, even the blind and the lame can sort you out. You'll never get in here. Verse 7, nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. The same is the city of David. And David said on that day, whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites and the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Wherefore they said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. So David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. And then he made it his capital city, and it had been so the city of David ever afterwards. Now, the first thing that strikes us, of course, is this. In God's book, what's counted important is not always the same as would be counted important in another book. You see, secular history would have had a few chapters on that. That would have been the greatest thing that David had ever done to that date. But God isn't just interested in exploits. Sometimes battles are given in detail. Sometimes just one or two verses full of mystery are put down, and before you know where you are, some tremendous change in the political and military situation has taken place. Because God's word has been inspired not just to give us interesting stories and political and military history, but to bring to us the truth that God wants us to hear and to read. But nevertheless, it does intrigue us. How did he get in? What happened? Well, east of Jerusalem, outside the city wall, there is a fountain, a kind of bubbling well. It's called in Old Testament times Gihon, G-I-H-O-N, which means bubbler, spring. It's called later on Fountain of the Virgin Mary, I believe, to this day. Of course, it's still there. And it was the main water supply for the ancient city of Jerusalem. That's why one of the gates out of the city was called the Water Gate, because people had to go through that gate and down the hill, fill up their pots with water, and then back again. It was in a rather inconvenient place from that point of view. Well, in 1867, there was a certain Captain Warren who was on a tour of the Holy Land, just like some of our younger fellowship have been on a tour of the Holy Land, and we were hearing from Sharon last week about it. Well, they used to do it in the last century as well, and this Captain Warren was on a tour, and he was with a group, and they came to this place, and the guide was giving all the history of it. But he was an inquisitive man, was Captain Warren, and he was looking all around. He noticed a very dark cavern up above where they were standing. And he asked the Arab guide, what's up there? But the Arab guide hadn't got that as part of his repertoire, so he couldn't answer that question. He said he didn't know, so they had to pass on to the next site. But Captain Warren was back there the week later with some ropes and some equipment. He was a bit of a rock climber. And away he went to investigate what there was up there. And he found himself in a kind of shaft. And up he went, up this rock-hewn shaft, until he found himself in the ancient city of Jerusalem, within the city wall. Obviously, what the Jebusites had done, and after all it was a very wise and sensible thing to do, to take precaution, for if they were besieged and their water supply was running low, which it might very likely do, so that they didn't have to open the water gate and send somebody for a quick run down the hill to get a pot full and run back up again, which wouldn't have been a very successful scheme, they had cut a little shaft and a tunnel right through the rock, right down. So all on the QT, they could just lower things and get some water. But David had got a very good CIA network or intelligence, MI5 or whatever it was, network. And he knew all about this shaft. And he said, right, who's going to volunteer? I want some commandos who will volunteer to get up the water shaft. And we'll sort out the halt and the lame and the blind and so on. And so Jerusalem was taken by what seems to have been a bloodless coup. And he found himself in there. Well, what about Hezekiah's tunnel? 2 Kings 20, verse 20. Let's look up several references and then put them together. 2 Kings 20, verse 20. I'll have to hurry up, so because of the time, so if I leave you behind with the references, you can catch up later on, take a note of them. And the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made a pool and a conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And then Hezekiah slept with his fathers. Good for him. Right. Well, let's look at the book of the Chronicles then. 2 Chronicles 32. 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 50. There isn't a verse 50, so that's clever. 2 to 4. Let's look at that first of all. It's describing an attack by Sennacherib upon Jerusalem. 32:2-4. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come, and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city, and they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? And then verse 30, not verse 50, verse 30. The same Hezekiah also stopped the upper watercourse of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works. Well, this was Hezekiah's tunnel. Once again, you see, he was concerned that during a siege they should have a water supply. So the Bible tells us in a very brief sentence or two that when Sennacherib's great army, which had already conquered the northern kingdom of Israel and its capital Samaria, and came sweeping down like locusts into Judah, eventually came and surrounded Jerusalem, he had already made it difficult for them to find any water by stopping up all the wells, just like retreating armies blow up all the bridges. But what about his own water supply? Well, in 1880, two Arab boys were either playing around the pool of Siloam in Jerusalem, or some people say they were swimming in it. Another story is that they were playing around it and one fell in, and then he was swimming in it. But whatever was the true story, one of them suddenly found himself in a strange tunnel. He managed to get out, but he very wisely and sensibly reported it to somebody, and they went back and they found the place and they investigated it. They discovered that it was 500 yards long. It was a winding tunnel cut through the rock. It was 5 feet high, and it led to the bubbling spring, the Gihon spring. The water was and is about knee-deep, and they found an inscription in Phoenician Hebrew, which is now in the Istanbul Museum, all about how the hewers started at either end and how they rejoiced when they met in the middle. I should think they did. It would have been rather disastrous if they'd missed each other. But the cuts in the rock, you can see they came from two directions. And there are two theories as to why it winds around instead of going straight. One is because it was having to be corrected constantly. They must have had some means of knowing that they weren't going to meet, and they had to keep correcting. The other theory is that they were told to avoid David and Solomon's tomb, but nobody has ever found David and Solomon's tomb. However, there you are, you see, things are coming to light all the time which are mentioned in the Bible. What about Daniel and Belshazzar? The book of Daniel. And chapter 5. Now, chapter 5 of the book of Daniel begins, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords. And so on. Belshazzar this, Belshazzar that. But according to the archaeologist, complete lists of the kings of Chaldea have been found, and there was no mention of any Belshazzar. In fact, the last king was called Nabonidus. Nabonidus, or Nabonidus. And the lists were complete, there appeared to be no break in the lists, and so it seemed as if the spade was working against the history of the Bible. And the archaeologists, some of them were saying, there you are, we found the mistake in the Bible. There never was a king Belshazzar. And the book of Daniel is just the fairy story. But in 1874, Sir Henry Rawlinson was excavating at Ur of the Chaldees, which I've mentioned before, and he came across a terracotta inscription. It belonged to Nabonidus, the very same, and on it said these words, Belshazzar, my eldest son. So at least it proved there was a person called Belshazzar, and he was of royal blood. But, of course, that didn't say that he was the king. But some people had said there was never any such person. So that was something very interesting, and Rawlinson went on digging and looking. And in 1876 he found some jars with 2,000 clay tablets in. And he also found many other finds. And on these tablets he learned some interesting things. He learned, for example, that Nabonidus was always campaigning with his armies in the west. And that he even settled in a place called Tama in Edom, over in the west. He was always away from his capital and from his own country. And the priests got very angry because the New Year feasts came and went without him. And they felt that there would be judgment from the gods upon them if this continued. So, his eldest son, Belshazzar, was appointed regent or king in his absence. His name, Belshazzar's name, never went down upon the official archives as the king because his father outlived him. But he served and acted as king there in the time of Daniel in the absence of his father. And the interesting thing is this, if you look at verse 16 of Daniel 5, and the last sentence, where this king is saying what wonderful things will happen to Daniel, it says at the end, and shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. Why the third ruler? Why not the second ruler? I'm the king, Belshazzar. I'll make you the second ruler in the kingdom. But he doesn't say that. He says he'll make him the third ruler. Why the third ruler? Well, because he, Belshazzar, was really only the second. Because Nabonidus was away. And so you see how fascinating is the testimony of the spade. I just have one other for you tonight from the New Testament. And that's in Acts chapter 17 and verse 6. Of course, we could go on through the Old Testament and look at many other things and the New Testament as well. But we'll just look at one from the New Testament, Acts 17 and verse 6, because it relates to our Sunday ministry. Acts chapter 17, you remember, is the story of Paul at Thessalonica. And we read it two Sunday mornings ago, our first lesson when we were going to expound the epistle of Paul to the Thessalonians. And we read the story of what happened when he went there, preached the gospel there. Do you remember how he was, they got up some layabout fellows, lewd fellows of the baser sort, verse 5, yobbos, a new translation, and they brought Jason before the magistrates. When they found them not, verse 6, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, these that have turned the world upside down are come hither also. Now, the word rulers there in the Greek is politarchas, the politarchs. They brought them to the politarchs, the magistrates, the rulers of the city. But that is a word which is found nowhere else, or at least it wasn't. Doesn't appear anywhere else in the New Testament. And there was a mystery, at any rate, attached to why Luke should use this particular term for magistrate. Some even said that he had misplaced his language, because that was not the usual word for a magistrate in a Roman city, a conquered city. And so Luke was an unreliable historian. But since then, archaeologists have discovered that the magistrates at Thessalonica were called politarchs. It was a special technical term for those who ruled in that particular city. And Luke, in fact, is showing him how careful a historian he was, because he isn't content to merely use a general word for magistrate, which he could have used. He is careful to use, in each case, as precise a word and as exact a word as he possibly could. After all, he was on that journey. He knew what he was writing about, even apart from our belief in the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. So we could go on. We don't base our belief in the truth of the Bible upon the testimony of the spade. But what we do find is, again and again, the testimony of the spade, most interestingly and encouragingly, throws light upon the sacred word and confirms the history of God's book.